Thanks to David for inviting me to come to this talk. So I'm going to explain about certain nice bases for representations and the combinatorics that arise from them. So let G be a complex reductive group. So the main example to keep in mind, if you haven't seen these before, if you're not so familiar, is the n by n invertible matrices. So we're going to be studying the representation theory of these groups, so finite dimensional representation theory. And the first thing I want to say is that the representation theory is easy in a certain sense. I mean, namely, it's semi-simple. So there's a certain number of irreducible representations, and every other representation is isomorphic to a direct sum of irreducible representations. So the irreducible representations, the IREPs, are labeled by the set of dominant integral weights. So in our example of GLNC, this set is the set of lists of n integers, except they have to be decreasing. And in general, for an arbitrary complex reductive group, it's always going to be some Z lattice and satisfying, but the subset satisfying some inequalities. So that's what this set of dominant integral weights will be. So for each lambda in this set of dominant integral weights, there's a representation V lambda. Just as the simplest example, if, again, we're in GLNC, so of course, GLNC acts on CN in a natural way, and if it also acts on, say, any exterior power of CN, which KCN. And in fact, these are both irreducible representations. This corresponds, so this is V lambda for lambda with the 1 and then all zeros, and this is V lambda for lambda with K1s and then all zeros. And there's some general construction of such irreducible representations for any lambda. But, well, it's not exactly what I'm going to talk about today. Well, so what's one aspect of this representation theory of these complex reductive groups is that each G contains a T, a maximal torus. So this is a subgroup isomorphic to C star to some power. So in our example, where we have GLNC, this will be the subgroup consisting of invertible diagonal matrices. So each entry has to be an invertible complex number. Now, when we have a representation of G on, say, one of our IREPs V lambda, of course, the torus now acts, and this decomposes under the action of the torus, because the torus is abelian, and since we're in this finite dimensional setting, we can just decompose this into places where the torus acts by certain characters, mu. So this weight decomposition labeled by the characters of the torus. So here lambda is the set of homomorphisms from the torus into C star. So one-dimensional representation of the torus.
Could you write a little harder?
Sure. Okay. So this is kind of a short summary of the representation theory. So now from this summary, there are two combinatorial questions that I'd like to bring up. Questions? So the first is, what is the dimension of this weight space, V lambda mu? So for each lambda, we have the representation, and for each lambda and mu, we get this weight space. So it's a vector, it's a finite dimensional vector space. So we can ask, what's its dimension? Is there some nice combinatorial answer for way to calculate this? And the second question, which turns out to be quite related, is suppose I take two of these representations, v lambda and v mu, and I compute their tensor product. Well, because the representation theory is semi-simple, this will decompose as a direct sum over nu's, so lambda plus, into various copies of nu's to some multiplicities, lambda mu nu. So the question is, what is m lambda mu nu? So these questions are called, respectively, the weight multiplicity question and tensor product multiplicity question. So these questions are very old, and this dates back to the early 20th century. But today I would like to talk about a certain kind of modern approach to answering these questions, which has maybe only really been developed in the past 15 years. So the approach the approach has two parts. The first is to construct nice bases for these representations V lambda. And the second part is to find describe the combinatorial objects which index these bases. So what exactly does this mean by nice bases? Well, it's most clear for answering the first question if you can make a basis for V lambda that consists of weight vectors, namely each basis vector lies in a particular V lambda mu, then you'll get a basis for each V lambda mu, so you can find the dimension of V lambda mu just by counting the number of basis vectors, and then once you have these combinatorial objects that describe the basis vectors, then you'll get an answer just by counting certain combinatorial objects. For question two, while it seems a little more, a little bit less straightforward right away, it turns out to be not much more complicated. If you can really find nice bases, then you can answer these questions one and two. So these things here will allow you to answer these. These combinatorial questions motivated these one and two here. So one thing I would like to say in this talk is that I think this has turned out to be a very, not just a fruitful approach for answering this question, but a very fruitful line of inquiry, in that there's a rich structure on this side that is much richer than just using it to find these numbers on the left side. So in the talk today, I would like to explain some way of carrying out this side. But I should explain there's actually lots of ways to do this. And they're all kind of non-trivial. It would be very difficult to explain more than one at once. So I'm really only going to explain one way. I mean, especially one is non-trivial. So I should say that one usually requires some geometry. And it's quite difficult. So I'm going to explain a version of this using Mirkovich-Vilonen cycles. But before I do that, there's actually one case in which you can carry out this sort of approach very simply. And so I'm going to do that first, just to illustrate what's going on. So that's Gelf and Setlin theory. So this just works for GLN. It just happens to be a good trick that works for GLN. So you've exploited the fact that for GLN, there's a copy of GLN minus 1 inside of it, namely the copy, you just add 1 and zeros. So copy of GLN minus 1 inside GLN. Now, suppose I take a representation for GLN. So V lambda is a irreducible representation of GLN. So that means that lambda, like what I said at the beginning, is a sequence of n decreasing integers. Now I can restrict the representation GLN minus 1 and see how the V lambda decomposes. So this dilemma that drives the Gelfand-Setlin business is that when you do this, so a priori you get various different representations of GLN minus 1, and possibly you might think you get them with certain multiplicities. But the first thing is that you only get multiplicity 0 and 1. And moreover, you can see exactly which mu you do get. So the direct sum over mu's, and they have to satisfy the following condition. So lambda 1 should be bigger than mu 1, bigger than lambda 2, bigger than or equal to mu n minus 1, bigger than lambda n. So of course, the mu's are decreasing, but not only are they decreasing, they interleave the original lambda. So there may be lots of choices for such mu, and the direct sum of those choices gives you V lambda. So now, once you've done this restricting from GLN to GLN minus 1, well, then you can keep going and take each of these V mu and decompose them under GLN minus 2. So if originally we had our lambda 1 to lambda n, and then we restricted and we got some mu 1 to mu n minus 1, then when we restrict GLN minus 2, we'll get some, it'll decompose each of these V mu's into new 1 to new n minus 2. And we'll carry this out, and eventually we're going to write the whole thing as a direct sum of GL1 representations. But GL1 representations are just one-dimensional. They're just representations of C star. So when we complete this thing, we'll have written V lambda as a direct sum of one-dimensional vector spaces. So these would be some sort of box. So this is a one-dimensional vector space. And what's the combinatorial object that indexes this decomposition? Well, it's the sets of these triangles. So a triangle where on the bottom is lambda 1 to n, and then you have a mu 1, and so on, and so on, and so on. And the condition is that each row must interleave the previous row. So these are called Gelfand-Setlin triangles. So maybe I should make it a triangle. Triangles. So this is direct sum indexed by Gelfand-Setlin triangles. We haven't quite made a basis, but we've made a decomposition of a vector space into one-dimensional subspaces, which is just about as good as a basis. And certainly this basis is good enough to answer. So we've constructed a basis, and we've described the combinatorial objects that index the basis. Now, you might ask, is it a nice basis? Well, I never really exactly said what nice was. But as a preliminary definition, we could say nice is a basis which is a weight basis. Namely, you have one thing in each. Namely, it restricts to a basis for each weight space. And it's quite easy to show that this basis is indeed a weight basis. But, of course, this. This Gelfand-Setlin approach really only works for GLN. I guess you can do maybe a similar thing for SP as well. But let's just say that it works just for nicely for Jalen. So now I'd like to outline a different approach, which works in general. But as I said before, I mean, it's not like this approach I'm about to explain is the approach that works in general, because there are a few approaches that work in general. It's just the one that one that I like. So this approach is by this Merkovich Vilonen cycles. So to do this, we're going to have to introduce some rather non-trivial geometry. So the first thing we should do is, so we started with our group G. So now let G check be the Langlands dual group. Langlands dual group. So what's the Langlands dual group? Well, a complex reductive group is the same thing as the data. As giving a complex reductive group is the same thing as giving a root datum. And a root datum consists of a weight lattice. That's the weight lattice. So that's the homomorphisms from the torus of G into C star. It consists of a set of roots, a co-weight lattice, and a set of co-roots. So this is a set of roots. This is a set of co-roots. And this is Hom from C star into our maximal torus. But so I won't exactly say what exactly the conditions are that such a thing as a root datum. But in any case, if you have one of these root datum, basically these two things sort of play a symmetric role as these two things. So if this is a root datum, then this is also a root datum. And this is a root datum that corresponds to a different group, which we call the Langlands dual group. So for our purposes, the most important thing to remember is that the maximal torus of this group, which say I'll call T-check, has the property that Hom from C star into T-check is the same thing as Hom from our original the torus, our original group, into C star, which is what I called lambda, the weight lattice, before. Now, this whole Langlands dual thing, for our basic example of GLN, there's not very much to worry about because the Langlands dual of GLN is still GLN. So I'm continuing with this geometric construction. So now we define the affine Grassmannian for the group G check. So we take K, the ring of Laurent series, and O, the subring of Taylor series. And we define the Grassmannian for G check is defined to be the G check of K modulo G check of O. So in our example where G is GLN, so then GLN check is also GLN, this is invertible matrices where the entries are Laurent series, modulo invertible matrices where the entries are Taylor series. So entries of it, well, so you can imagine what such a matrix looks like. So this affine Grassmannian has the structure of an in scheme. So it's kind of infinite dimensional, but it can be dealt with in algebraic geometry using the language of in schemes. Namely, it's infinite dimensional, but it's inductive. It's an increasing union of finite dimensional schemes. In fact, finite dimensional projective varieties. So what's an example of a point in this space? So this is a very big space, so it has a lot of points. So one example, so for example, for GLN, we can look at say we have any mu 1 to mu n in Z, then I can form what I would call T to the mu, which is the matrix where it's diagonal matrix, so the entries are T to the mu 1, T to the mu n. So it's definitely a matrix where the entries are Laurent series. In fact, they're monomials. So this is an element of the Grassmannian. I take the covalence class in this quotient. And more generally, if I have any mu in this lattice, lambda, so such a mu corresponds to a map from C star into T check. And if you have a map from C star into T check, that gives you an element I call T of the mu in, well, it would be in T check of K. So in particular, it gives you an element. So I'll call also T of the mu in the affine Grassmann. So this affine Grassmannian sort of makes an important appearance in the geometric Langlands program. And I'm not going to really talk about that aspect of it today. A talk for another occasion. So we have this infinite dimensional scheme, this affine Grassmannian. Now we want to look at the action of G check of O acting from the left. So we have G check of K modulo G check of O. And of course, and we can consider left multiplication here. So we have a G check of O acting here. So you should think of this. So you notice this thing was called affine Grassmannian, but maybe you didn't notice that right now. Affine Grassmannian. So in certain ways, it's analogous to the ordinary Grassmannian. What's the ordinary Grassmannian? Well, that's this set of k-planes in Cn. Or it's more convenient for us right now, we can think of it as GLN modulo the following subgroup consisting of matrices that are zero inside a n minus k by k rectangle here. So this is these two things are equal because this acts transitively on the set of k-planes, and this is the stabilizer of the standard k-plane. So I was saying this is, in a way, this space, this quotient is a little bit analogous to this quotient, which, in general, in the theory of reductive groups, there's a whole study of quotients of G groups by their by parabolic subgroups, and this fits into that framework. And in that theory, it's interesting to study the action of the group you're quotienting by acting by multiplication on the left. So that's what we do in this case. So we look at this action coming from multiplication on the left, and now we want to describe the orbits. So the lemma is so let's say that the Grassmannian is the union, the disjoint union of the orbits, and it's enough just to take the orbits through each point T to the lambda. So T to the lambda, that's element this, except lambda just varies over this dominant part of the weight lattice. So for GLN, this consists of, this is T lambda 1, T lambda n, with lambdas decreasing. So for GLN, this kind of thing you can do sort of by, elementary means of multiplying matrices, or think about row operations. You can take any matrix, think about a matrix where the entries are of Laurent series, and you're allowed to do you're allowed to do column operations and row operations, but you're only allowed to use Taylor series when you do those operations. Then you can reduce any matrix to one of the form T to lambda 1 to T to lambda n with lambdas decreasing. So this orbit, I'm going to denote Gur upper lambda. So now I'd like to state a sort of important theorem for this part, which is this is a version of an aspect of the geometric Satake theorem, which is due to a number of people. So let me list a few. Say, Lustig, Ginzburg, and Mirkovich-Vilonen. But even perhaps others should be added. So one thing to notice is that, so we started with our group G, and this set here, lambda plus, that labeled the irreducible representations of G. Now we've switched over to G-check, and the same set is labeling these orbits in the afferent Grassmannian. So you might suspect that this Gur lambda is somehow related to the representation V lambda. Or you might not suspect it, but it turns out it is. And what's the relation? Well, so what is, wait, maybe I should just back up a little bit. What is Gur lambda? So Gur was an in scheme. Well, it turns out once we do this, so we're just looking at some subset of it, namely this orbit, and that's actually it's actually now finite dimensional. So this is finite dimensional. In fact, Gur lambda bar is now a finite dimensional projective variety. And there's a good cohomology theory for finite dimensional projective varieties, namely the theory of intersection homology, which is developed by McPherson and Gretzky and McPherson. And this theory is good because it satisfies, well, for a number of reasons, but so it's the one that we should use here. So the theorem is that the intersection homology of Gur lambda bar is canonically isomorphic to the representation V lambda. So this, a priori, is not a representation. It's just a finite dimensional vector space. Well, this is also finite dimensional vector space. I mean, it has a structure of representation. But I'm just saying that these two finite dimensional vector spaces are canonically isomorphic. So exactly how this can be and how this works, right now it looks a little bit mysterious. So, I'm going to give an example. But I'm not going to try to explain aspect of the proof of this theorem. Maybe, again, it's for another time. So the example is if you take lambda to be 1, 1, 1, and then 0, 0, 0. So we have k1s. And now we look at, so then it turns out that Gur lambda bar is the same thing as Gur lambda. Namely, this bar is the closure inside the afferent Grassmannian. So it just turns out that this is a closed orbit. And so a point in this Gur lambda, well, that looks like, say, g of t, that's acting on t to the lambda. So here g of t is an element of g of o. And of course, given a g of t, since it's in g of o, it's a matrix where the coefficients, so I should say this is example for GLN. It's a matrix where the coefficients are Taylor series. So since the coefficients are Taylor series, we can plug in 0. When the Taylor series is a nice property, you can substitute 0. So we can take this over to G of 0. Now we have a matrix. So that's an element of GLN. And now we're going to look at the quotient of GLN by the same parabolic subgroup that I told you about before that had k blocks of k. Block of k n minus k, that's 0 in the top right. And I look at I think I've slightly exaggerated how much is 0. it's really only minus 1. The edge of the block is not 0. Okay, so what am I saying? I'm defining a map from this Gur lambda, this orbit of G of O, to this quotient by if G of T dot T lambda is taken to the class of G of 0 in this quotient. And this we already saw was isomorphic to the Grassmannian of K planes and Cn. And so the like statement, so maybe make some claim, and it's very easy to check, is that this is an isomorphism. So now so this theorem says we're supposed to look at the intersection cohomology, the intersection homology of this Gur lambda. Well, in this case, that's the same thing as intersection homology of the Grassmannian of K-planes and Cn. But the Grassmannian of K-planes and Cn is smooth, so this is just the same thing as the ordinary homology of the Grassmannian of K-planes and Cn. And the Grassmannian of K-planes and Cn has a nice, for the homology, has a nice basis. It has a basis, and this has a basis, given by Schubert varieties. And Schubert varieties, if you recall, they're indexed, which are indexed by K element subsets of 1 to n. Okay, but now if I look at the right-hand side of this and look at V lambda, before I told you before what V lambda was, namely it's the kth exterior power of Cn. And, well, that also has a basis indexed by k element subsets of 1 to n. So you can take this calculation two ways. One, you can say that I've just checked that this theorem is true for this lambda, at least that, so this vector space is isomorphic to this vector space. I mean, they have the same dimension anyway, n choose k. But, or you can, another way to think of this is, well, suppose I really believe this theorem and I didn't need to use this example to convince you, then you would see that, well, now, and you didn't know very much about this V lambda, well, now then you would have concluded that this V lambda has a basis indexed by K element subsets of 1 to n, because this homology has a basis indexed by K element subsets of 1 to n. So that's the kind of thing we want to do in general. Because in general, there's not such a simple description of V lambda or a simple description of a basis for lambda. That's the whole point. But, so, okay, so where are we now? So we have a description of the vector space V lambda as the intersection homology of some variety. But now you'd like to say, well, but now we need a basis for this intersection homology. I mean, the whole point was to get a basis for this. So my argument is it's easier to make a basis here. For example, here is a basis by Schubert varieties. So how can we generalize the Schubert varieties? So the answer is there does exist such a thing. So, well, what's one definition of a Schubert variety? So we look at Gur Kn. So this has an action of, so I said before, this is an action of GLn. And inside GLn, there's a torus that we've talked about before. And inside that torus, there's a particular copy of C star, namely, it's the copy of C star looking like matrices S to the n, S1. So instead of this, which is S and C star. That's a copy of C star sitting inside, eventually inside GLn. Maybe S to the n minus 1. It's S to the n minus, it's a matrix, it's a diagonal matrix, the entries are S to the n minus 1, S to the n minus 2, and so on down to 1, which is a, and this is a subgroup of GLn isomorphic to C star. And this, so this C star acts on this Grassmannian, in the fixed points, are just the coordinate subspaces. Namely, if Cn is the span of E1 through En, then the fixed points are those subspaces here, which are of the form span EI1 EIK. So the fixed points are given of this form. And so let's call this, say, W sub I1 through IK. So now we can define X sub I1 through IK to be the set of all W in Riemannian such that the limit as S goes to 0 of S acting on W is this fixed point, WI1. Basically what we have is we have attributes somehow for the simplest case of like K equals 1 and N equals 2. You have a line and then you act by S and you sort of fold the line until it becomes a coordinate line. So that's the action of S, taking it down to be a coordinate line. So X is the set of all W that limit to our given fixed point under this action. And then the Schubert variety is defined to be the closure of this thing. So this is this is part of some general principle. If you have some manifold M with the C star action, one way to think about M is to think about the fixed points of C star acting on M, and then for each fixed point, look at the set of all the set of all elements of M which flow to that fixed point under the C star action. So it's sort of an algebraic version of Morse theory, and this is called Bielenicki-Birula decomposition. So this is one way to get Schubert varieties, which are a way to get a basis for the homology of the Grassmannian. So the idea is, well, can we do an analogous thing and get a basis for the intersection homology of this Gr lambda, which we saw in a very special case was the Grassmannian, namely the finite Grassmannian, finite dimensional Grassmannian. So what do we do? Well, first we have to find, where's the C star? Well, so we have the Grassmannian is G check of K, my G check of O, and I said, before we have an action of the entire group G check of K acting on the left, but in particular we have an action of G acting on the left, and inside G we have a torus T check, and so let's pick a C star inside that torus. So in the case of GLN, then we'll pick the same C star we picked last time. So that gives us an action of C star on the entire Grassmannian. And it's clear that this descends to an action on the orbit or the closure of the orbit, Gr lambda bar, because it was just an orbit of G check of O. These things are sitting inside G check of O. Now, what I should have said maybe first is the fixed points. The fixed points of this action of C star are exactly these T to the mu's that I was telling you about earlier. So we can see that very simply for GLN. What does it mean to be a fixed point for this action? So I have some matrix for the entries of the Laurent series. I'm going to multiply that matrix by a diagonal matrix. And then I want it to be the same matrix. Well, I don't actually want it to be the same matrix. I mean, I want it to be the same matrix if I can right multiply. So if I multiply on the left by a diagonal, if I multiply two diagonal matrices, well, they commute, and then I can push the other diagonal matrix out here. So it's definitely these things are fixed points. And then it's not so hard to check that they're the only fixed points. So these are the fixed points. So in particular, even in our Girl lambda bar, some of these will be fixed points. So let's consider the set of, let me call it L, in Girl lambda bar, such that the limit S goes to 0 of S of I L is T to the mu. So the way I want to think about it, I want to fix lambda first, and now I'm going to try to do this for each mu. So somehow, there's some picture, which maybe I'll explain a little bit more what this picture means later. But this is kind of a picture of Girl lambda bar. And here is a mu. And what I'm doing is I'm looking at all the stuff that flows up to mu under this C stack. Either up or down. I'm not quite sure which one. Okay. So, yeah. Now, this case is a bit more complicated than what we had there. And the reason why it's more complicated is because Girl lambda bar is not smooth, unlike the Grassmannian of k-planes and Cn. And because it's, Girl lambda bar is not smooth, and worse, it's not smooth at these fixed points t of the mu. In fact, it's pretty easy to see that the only t to the mu that lie in Girl lambda before we take the closure, Girl lambda is the smooth part of Girl lambda bar, and the only t to the mu that lie in Girl lambda are just the Weyl group orbits of lambda. So that's not going to be very interesting. So
what you're saying, you mean in general it's not smooth? In this case over here, it was this Grassmannian, right?
Yeah, in that case it is smooth. Sorry, in general it's not smooth. It's not smooth whenever, it's not smooth precisely because in this case, there was this equality, which I didn't quite explain, why the Girl lambda bar was just the same as Girl lambda.
Oh, the closure is always the trouble. Okay.
Yeah, so the problem is that when we take this closure, we pick up more t to the mu's. Well, those t to the mu's will turn out to be very important, but we pick up more t to the mu's, and there won't be smooth points of Girl lambda bar. So, that's bad. Because it's not smooth, it's not necessarily irreducible as an algebraic variety. So it may have more than one component. So now I have a definition, an MV cycle is maybe the closure of a component. I better give it a name of this space. Skr lambda bar. Let's say sub mu. So again, the simplest schematic picture is this one. If you take the set of things that flow to this point, then it turns out that there are two components, one sort of over here and one over here. Later on, maybe I'll tell you a bit more what these schematic pictures mean. Okay. So the theorem, which is due to Mirkovich and Vilonen, is that these MV cycles give a basis for the intersection homology of rho lambda bar. So just like the Schubert varieties give a basis for the ordinary homology, and just like in Morse theory in general, works well to give you basis for homology or cohomology, here we need to take all these components, but once we do that, then we get a basis. And there's some extra nice thing that happens. Well, if you remember, V lambda was, we had this, was isomorphic to Gr lambda. So now, of course, V lambda has a decomposition into weight spaces. So if this isomorphism is really canonical, then this should have a nice decomposition also into weight spaces. Well, now it does. I mean, namely, this is decomposed into mu, and that's an NB cycle of weight mu. So the span of the NB cycles of weight mu. Okay, so far so good in a sense. So we have now accomplished the task of making a basis for each representation V lambda. Namely, we have a basis where the basis vectors are these geometric objects, these Mirkovich-Milonen cycles. However, the second part of our task is a little bit more difficult now because, well, we have a basis, but we don't have a very good handle on the basis. Like, we don't have any kind of combinatorial thing to index the basis. In fact, we barely know what these MV cycles are. I mean, they're just the closures of some, they're just some components, basically, of this space. So, a little bit difficult. So there's this nifty idea called MV polytopes that I'd like to explain now. Okay. So if A is an MV cycle, let P of A be defined to be the set of all, the convex hull. So in particular, it's a polytope. It's a convex hull of some set. The convex hull of all the mu's such that T to the mu is in A. So let me draw my example. Maybe I should be more honest about this example. So this example that I keep sort of alluding to, this is lambda equals 2, 1, 0. So it corresponds to the action of GL3 on the, well, actually on the Lie algebra. Well, more corresponds to the action of SL3 on the Lie, on its Lie algebra. So, and in this case, there's, so first of all, hidden in this statement is that, well, of course, I mean, one first question you can ask is which are the possible T of the mu's for which this set is non-empty? And, well, so if you believe this theorem, that's going to be the same as which are the possible mu's for which this weight space is non-empty. And those are exactly, and there's a very good combinatorial answer for that question. Namely, if you're given a lambda, there's a, you can look at the Weyl group orbit through lambda. So for the case of GLN, that's simply the SN orbit of lambda. Namely, you look at all, so lambda was this decreasing thing, and then you look at all the possible permutations of it. So you have a, in this case, so N is 3, so the SN is 6 elements, so we have a Weyl group orbit. And the possible mu's such that this weight space is not empty is the all are exactly those mu's which live inside the convex hull of those points. This is the called the Weyl polytope. or sometimes permutahedron. So as a particular case of this, what I'm just been trying to convince you of is that the polytope, so there's a polytope associates, this associates the ETMB cycle, a polytope, namely consisting of all mu is such that T of the mu, the convex hull of all mu is such that T of the mu is in the polytope, is in the V cycle. Gur lambda bar is itself an V cycle by my definition. It just sort of follows because if you pick the right lambda, the closure of this is all of Gur lambda bar. Right? Just like if you pick the right subspace, then almost every point in the Grassmannian flows into the subspace under this C star action. So if you pick the sort of bottom of the Morse flow, or however people say it, then you get Gur lambda bar. So Gur lambda bar is itself an MV cycle, and so its polytope is just this vial polytope, the convex hull of the vial group orbit through lambda. So here's lambda is 210, and here's its vial group orbit. And here, let's look at mu to be 111, sitting in there. And so this, so I said before, there's the space, if you look at the set of things, the limit to 111, it actually has two components. And one of them contains these three fixed points. So that's one MV polytope. And the second one contains three fixed points. So that's the other MV polytope. And obviously, you have no way to verify these facts that I'm telling you, but just to give you an idea of what these MV polytopes can look like and how they can sort of fit together to show you the...
But they don't fill it all up, though.
Well, they will... Well, this is the MV polytopes for this weight. So these are the ones that flow up to this weight.
And then any other weight in P1 would produce P1 by this process? Or?
Yeah, there's actually no more weights in this area.
Okay.
Then if you look at this, say, the stuff that flows up to this weight, it actually turns out to be there's only one MV polytope, this one. If you look up to this weight, well, then you get the entire MV polytope. I mean, the entire vial polytope is the MV polytope. So this is a way of associating a commentary object to each MV cycle, namely the commentary object in question is the MV polytope. So now, theorem about MV polytopes is that, this associates a polytope, but you might not be obvious that this is really a bijection. Well, so the theorem is that this is a bijection. I mean, bijection is a strong word because I haven't told you what the right-hand side is. Maybe I should say it's injective. Namely, to each MV cycle, this associates a combinatorial object, and any two MV cycles are taken to different combinatorial objects, different polytopes. And the second part of the theorem is that these things are called MV. I guess maybe it's very obvious. This is called an MV polytope. So the set of MV polytopes, the set of polytopes that can be made as the image of an MV cycle under this procedure, the set of MV polytopes can be described explicitly. So in a sense, we've gone from this MV cycles where we had a basis, but it was very hard to get on that hands on that basis by any combinatorial description. Now when we pass to the level of the polytopes, this set of polytopes can be described. So maybe a couple of minutes. So. Well, I think maybe I'd just leave it at that. I think it might take more than a couple more minutes to exactly describe every palette system. So Tomáš asks, what's the answer to the question of dimension of weight multiplicity? Well, I mean, there's a lot of answers. I mean, some of them are more classical. But this approach, which I've outlined today, gives an answer. Namely, the answer is the weight multiplicity is the number. I haven't quite told you what this is, the number of MV polytopes. So I haven't quite told you explicitly what the MV polytopes are, but I mean it's possible to write it down, I mean, completely independently of anything else I've told you. So then we have a bijection. I mean, the MV cycles give a basis and they're labeled by MV polytopes. So the weight multiplicity is just the number of MV polytopes of a certain kind. So I can just say, to abbreviate it, I can just say four Gr lambda of R and of weight mu. So it's not really an exact, I mean, formula. There actually do exist more formula-like answers. Like, most classical is the Weyl character formula. But it doesn't have this form as the counting of something. And there are other answers which also have the form of the counting of some combinatorial logic. But I'm just saying this is one answer that's produced by this procedure.
Yeah? So for this adjoint representation of SL3, can you just tell us for each of the vertices around the edges what are the...
Yeah.
There's only one for each vertex again. But
yeah, so it's not going to be... There's something very wrong. So it's not going to be. So the question was to draw exactly the MV polytopes, which come up for this adjoint representation of SL3, and they are like this. So for this vertex, there's just a point. The MV polytope is just a point. For this vertex, it's an edge. For this vertex, it's an edge. For this vertex, there's two, as I said, some triangles. For this vertex, it's a this. For this vertex, looks like that. And for this vertex, it's the whole thing. And while I'm about it, I know this wasn't quite a question. Maybe this is what I should have done with my last 2 minutes. And maybe I'll do it now that I've thought of it. So anyway, the set of MV polytopes can be described explicitly. So for the case of GL3, it's very easy. So, well, for the case of GL2, it's extremely easy. Namely, it's just like, it's just intervals. For the case of GL3, it's easy and interesting. It consists of hexagons with the property that... So they're hexagons, but they have a sort of distinguished bottom and top vertex. Everything in this picture is sort of a bottom and a top in this flow. So the polytope ends up with a distinguished bottom and top vertex. So distinguished bottom and top vertex. And the hexagon has three diagonals. Let's call them A, B, C. And A is a kind of distinguished diagonal because it doesn't. The edges that it's across from aren't part of the top and bottom. A is a sort of wide part. So the equation is that A should be the max of B, C. So any hexagon that looks like this is an MV polytope for GL3. Any hexagon with this property.
Do these bases behave well under tensor product? Does this help you give something nice for question two?
The answer is, so the question is, what about question two about tensor product multiplicities? And in particular, do the bases behave well under tensor product? So it turns out it's always kind of a, I think it's a sort of more subtle question, what happens to the bases under tensor product, then does the combinatorics give you something good for the tensor product? So somehow the answer to the first question is always much harder. And the answer to the second question, I think, is yes, you get a nice answer. So maybe I should explain one more. I can explain a very simple answer to that question. So if these are all the MV polytopes, let me just back up a second. So this, say this is all the MV polytopes for GL3. But now if I pick a particular representation, V lambda, and ask what are the MV polytopes for that representation, well, what I have to do is I start by drawing the Weyl polytope for lambda, say this one. And then for each vertex, I look at all the possible abstract MV polytopes that have their highest weight at that vertex, their lowest weight at the bottom, and they fit inside the polytope. So if you analyze this and this, you get just exactly the ones which I drew and then erased. So the answer for weight multiplicities is, namely, I look at lambda, and here's say W naught lambda, and so weight mu is the polytopes. So the weight multiplicity count of the MV polytopes satisfying this abstract condition, and having their highest vertex at mu, the lowest vertex here, and fitting inside this guy. So the answer for tensor product multiplicities let's change this mu. So I'm going to put a. I have to also draw the Weyl polytope for mu, but now I draw it kind of upside down looking. So this is the Weyl polytope for mu, where I've shifted it by the nu. So this is mu. This is W naught mu minus plus nu. And now I count the polytopes. The highest vertex is here, and the lowest vertex is here. And they have to fit inside both this guy and this guy. So you do get a combinatorial answer for tensor product multiplicities as well. Answer to this question. Tamash? No. I don't think that there's really a direct relation. Another related question to that is, I mean, there's other combinatorial objects that where you can write a similar statement to the one I wrote there, except change MV polytopes to some other combinatorial object. And the question of finding, you know, bijections between the various combinatorial objects is interesting and kind of open and, well, partly solved in some cases and open in other cases.
Any more questions? Now let's thank Joel.